Welcome to Morph Into a New You, part of MHNRnetwork.com. Your host, Johnny Calloway, is the author of several books, including Taming the Dragon, Dragons to Butterflies, The Metamorphosis of a Man, and The Bridge. He will be having conversations with people from all walks of life. Healing really is an inside job that transforms you to become a better version of you. We must change our self-talk and inner dialogue so we can start to believe. A special thanks to our sponsor, Meaningful Expressions, at m-expressions.com. They can take a concept, thought, or personal brand and turn it into a visual masterpiece that you can use to raise awareness about your passion or cause. They've certainly done that with our podcast website. And thank you for joining Johnny as you morph into a new you.
Hello, everybody. I'm Johnny Calloway, host of Morph Into a New You, Changing Thoughts, Changes Lives. This month's theme is Coming to Believe, Where Hope Begins. And man, I'm telling you, speaking of that particular thing, I know I've gone on and on about what Eric Gentry's done for my recovery, but meeting Eric, then realizing, think about it this way until this moment, but when I met Eric at the place I was in when I met him, hope began because I started being able to see a way out. So today we're going to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder, bipolar addiction, and the importance of coming to believe. And Eric's going to bring us a twist about hope, the scientific value of hope as the show proceeds. And Eric, how you doing?
Doing great, Johnny.
I love when we get to do these things together, man. It's like I'm buzzed up. Eric, tell us a little bit about, from your clinical side and your experience, how PTSD, bipolar, and addiction all kind of intermingle with each other.
First of all, they're all three a description of distress, that they are the effects of a body that is constantly jacked up and seeking relief. You know, that's what all three of those conditions involve. And with post-traumatic stress disorder, it is getting away from the stuff that scares you. With bipolar, it is trying to manage both the overstimulation and the understimulation. With addiction, it is a state of constant dis-ease and the need to have something external. The essence of post-traumatic stress is the perception of threat. You know, what trauma does to a person is that it causes them to perceive threat where there's little or no danger. Chronic perceived threat, what happens is a person is chronically jacked up, that they got their heart rate, their muscles are clenched, there's all of this internal distress that is going on. It's similar with bipolar. Matter of fact, I've never worked with, you know, I've worked with 12,000 clients in 35 years of clinical practice, and I've yet to work with anybody that has bipolar disorder that does not have a significant history of trauma. But the thing that's a little bit different is that with bipolar, you're getting the jacked upness, but you also get the shutdowns and the real lows. So it's a back and forth and trying to manage that, the two ends of that. And then addiction, and I think it's all the same thing. I've not worked with anybody that has a history of addiction that doesn't have a history of trauma. And it's that chronic state of dis-ease and needing something outside of myself to comfort and soothe that distress that I'm in. That's kind of the overlap of the three of those.
I'm going to create a scenario here. Let's say I'm Johnny Calloway and I come to Eric for the first time as a patient or a client. And let's say I'm addicted, but I've decided the 12 steps don't work for me. What do you do with me? And I'm bipolar and I've suffered from trauma. I know in the 12 steps, one of the first things we try to do is get an addict to get a little bit of hope that maybe they can stay clean. But with someone that doesn't have that 12-step community or refuses to go there, what do you do with them?
Well, it's complex, but it's a multiplicity of things. The first thing I do is harm reduction. So I tell them that I will not work with them if they're using to intoxication. If they're willing to use to cut down their use so that they are just using to stave off withdrawal and that they don't get intoxicated, then I will work with them. And then if they agree to that, then I ask them to, okay, we're going to test that for the next 90 days or 60 days or whatever we decide to do. If it turns out that you are consistently using to the place of intoxication, what's our next step? Where do we go next? Because clearly that's demonstrating to you that you cannot control this on your own. So would intensive outpatient treatment be the next step for us? Or would you like to add, go all the way to inpatient treatment? Or I set up a contract with them so that if they are able to control it, then great, then they don't need to have a program. But if they're not able to control it, then what's happened is over 60 to 90 days, I've built a relationship with them and I can start to be the bridge that helps them to find their way into recovery or find their way into treatment or figure out how they want to decide to try to manage their chemical dependency.
I guess in essence, then, what I'm hearing is you try to create that hope for them by connecting with you. Some of our prior shows that you and I have done together, we talked about hope comes from connection. That connectivity that we get, say, the first time we call somebody from a 12-step room, they tell us, well, I've been exactly where you are and I don't have to be there anymore. Then a little bit of a light comes on. So when it's somebody that doesn't want to go to the 12 steps, you try to find a way through connecting with them to turn that light on for them or with them, right?
That's absolutely what I do. What we've learned in the past 15 years or so in the field of mental health is that the technical stuff that we do in therapy, you know, all the written homework, all the interventions that clinicians do account for very little of the change that happens. Most of the change that happens in therapy come from what we call the non-specific factors, the things that are not particular to a model, that are ubiquitous, that are in all phases of treatment. And the two most potent medicines in the field of mental health, number one is the quality of the therapeutic relationship. Number two is called positive expectancy. That's the second most powerful medicine. And positive expectancy, all good mental health professionals, our first and foremost job is to be the ambassador of hope. I mean, that's what we do in the first couple of sessions. If we cannot ignite a little bit of a flame of hope, a vision of something other than the death march that our clients are on, then it doesn't matter how skilled we are as clinicians, we won't get a chance to do that because they won't come back. That ability to light up that there's something else for the people that come to see us that give that person the wherewithal to walk through their fear to change.
Right.
That people will not walk into fear unless they believe that there's something on the other side that is valuable for them.
Right. I'm going to go to the 12-step rooms with this. One of the beautiful things about where hope comes from there is you actually get to physically see demonstrations of what hope can do. I've said probably at least 100 times in meetings, at least 100 times, that if you sit in these rooms long enough and you say you can't see God, you ain't looking. There's always somebody in that room that has risen above what they were never going to rise above without some kind of hope, connection, love. It's there.
Agreed. 100%. That process of, I think it's probably best to say this way, in the disorder of PTSD, up until 3 years ago, diagnostically, one of the symptoms was a sense of foreshortened future. And I think that addicts and survivors of trauma have that in common. There's been so much disappointment and so much pain that hope is a perceived threat. Hope is weakness. Hope is vulnerability. Hope is, you know, screw hope. And just that kind of nihilistic, by the time that we come into the rooms, you know, we just don't have hope. Too painful.
My personal experience with that is my attitude that I used to share lovingly in my early goings in the program was, there is no gravity. The earth just sucks. You couldn't penetrate that with hope because I was convinced. I was very fortunate, actually, that I did see hope right away. I did. I heard people talking about, they were telling my story, but they were telling it from a detached place from the story. I was still too involved in the story to be able to detach from it. But I heard them and I knew they couldn't be sharing what they were sharing, saying what they were saying with the passion they were saying it with if it was just something they read from a book. It was something I knew they had experienced. I knew they had gotten beyond it. The thing for me, when you can see that, that hope then goes kind of beyond hope to knowing. It reminds me of that thing you said in our very first show together. They asked what he believed and he said, no, I don't. I know. Right?
It was the spiritual father of the 12 steps.
Carl Jung. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. On the Dick Cavett show. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of what it does. That process of being able to connect with another person who is scared and an island, and building a bridge between one human being and another. And sometimes that's with humor. Sometimes that's with just self-disclosure. Sometimes that's with being able to just be quiet and look at them with a soulful look. That process of where we help people to take the first step out of their protection, their first step beyond their armor, their first step without a weapon, whether that's a true weapon that they're carrying, hardware, or the software weapons that we carry inside of us, the way that we defend ourselves against the world. The first time somebody steps out from behind their rock and begins to explore the world, you know, how do you work the program with honesty, open-mindedness, willingness? That open mind is the first step to hope. That's what has to happen, is there's got to be the willingness to look at things a little bit differently.
Right. And my personal experience is so vital, because I had convinced myself that so many lies. I've got another lady I do podcasts with, Mary Padlack. She talks about how we're hypnotized as children to believe the lies that we're told. And part of recovery, coming from her angle, is about de-hypnotizing ourselves from those lies. And a lot of those lies, I lived my life based on a belief system that I didn't believe, but I never checked it out. I never, like, do I really believe that? No, I was told that. I bought it and I ran with it. And a big part of my personal recovery has been about investigating the belief system that I run my life by. I can say, in all honesty, most everything I believe when I came to the 12 steps in 1984 is gone. My connection with what I thought God was, what love was, what relationship was, everything has been turned around. But I had to first be willing to look at it and say, you know what? To tie into what you were saying, you know what? Maybe I've been wrong. Maybe all this stuff I've run my life by was wrong. And there's so much freedom in that. So much freedom that we have a mutual friend, Ed, that told me way back in the beginning for me, after listening to me pontificate for about 45 minutes about my ideas about God, he just listened. And when I was done, he said, I hope I don't ever forget this. He said, it might behoove you to be open to the idea that perhaps everything you think you know about God could be wrong. And over the years, everything I thought at that moment has changed. And I was just having a conversation yesterday, actually, with a dear friend. And I really try to live in the space of maybe I'm wrong. Maybe if I let myself think there's a possibility that I'm wrong, there's something else here for me to learn. There's a line in A Course in Miracles that says the essential thing to learning anything is to first know that you do not know. In that place, I am constantly open to learning. I can't say I'm constantly learning, but I'm constantly open to learning in that place. And yeah, maybe I'm constantly learning in that place, but that open-mindedness is vital.
I appreciate the way that you said about that process of hearing other people's stories. And I was just thinking while you were talking there about the two processes of hope in the 12 steps, because there is the pre-first step hope. Before we ever actually work or take a first step, is we start seeing people that acted the way that we acted, that went to the horrors that we went through, and they're not suffering from that anymore. And that gives me enough wherewithal to begin that maybe I'll try this program. And then, you know, I was thinking about how the first step, that to be able to live by hope and faith and love, to be able to live by spiritual principles, what we got to do is that we got to find that we do not have enough power on our own to be able to manage our lives. That's what happens in the first step, is that a first step done right, you come out of that first step with a little bit of hopelessness. It's like there's nothing left for me to be able to try to manage my life. I can't do it. I have the disease of addiction. And if I try to run things, then I'm going to drive my car into the ditch every single time. Now, there's a loss in that. There is a death of ego that comes with that. But what's really cool is it's the propulsion to send us into the second step, where we got to come to believe if we want to stay clean and have any kind of life. You know, a first step without a second step is a suicide waiting to happen.
Right.
There's just nothing without, if all you got's a first step, you ain't staying clean, and you definitely are not going to have a quality of life.
I've been working on this workshop, this Morph Into a New workshop I'm wanting to do. And I take a different approach to the first step, where it's open to more than just someone that's addicted to a particular substance. And it's, we admitted we were powerless over our thinking and that our lives had become unmanageable. And the point in that is I'm trying to open up that it's my thinking that drives me to do all this crazy stuff. And those thoughts are unmanaged. So if I can learn to manage the thoughts with the rest of the steps, then my unmanaged thoughts become managed thoughts and my unmanageable life becomes a manageable life. Does that make sense from where you're coming from?
It does, but it's tricky. The tricky part is that I cannot manage my, this is for me, I can't manage my thoughts with strife.
That's why the other steps are so important.
First blush, when I hear what you say, and I suspect that other people might do this too, is, oh, all I got to do is manage my thoughts. Well, let me just try harder. And that what has to, yeah, I mean, that's where that's going to go. That's where that's going to, I mean, if I heard that at 90 days clean, that's exactly what I would have done, is I would have tried harder. But what we've learned about those thoughts that are destructive and distorted, the reason why they're destructive and distorted is because they're not really even thoughts. They're intrusions. They're old stuff intruding. A thought is when the frontal lobe talks to the temporal lobe and intentionally constructs language internally. And that's not what's happening with most people who are in the rooms. Right. They're not intentionally thinking. They are desperately trying to figure out a way out of the situation or the circumstance that they're in because they're in such discomfort. So the only way to be able to bring thoughts under control is through a process of surrender, not with aggression. It's got to be a let go. That, I love that, man. There's just that the entrance to heaven is only through surrender. You can't get to peace by fighting for it.
Right. I will work with that. I trust you immensely. And I know that what you're saying is so. Most people are going to say, okay, I'll just change the way I think. I do believe that changing what we think is vital, but
I agree.
I know for myself, it's almost like a mathematical equation for me. A thought becomes a feeling becomes a belief becomes behavior, my behavior becomes my life. So if I can change the thought that started all of that, I can change my life. But first, I got to identify those thoughts that need to be changed. On our first show, the first show that you and I did, and you talked about the traumatized person being robbed of hope. And from that point on, they're jacked up and they're constantly reacting to stimuli with either fight or flight. Man, that was me. There was no, that's why when they said to me in the rooms, think it through, that was so important for me because what I realized almost immediately with that is I never thought about anything. I had thoughts that were immediately followed with events. If I thought there's dope in that house, I went in after it. I didn't think about the possible consequences until they were putting my ass in the back seat of the car. And I'm like, man, wish I'd thought that through.
Yeah.
But there was no, like you were saying, there was no connection between those two parts of the brain. It was just like, think it, do it. And that's why that learning to think, I say this to people in rooms all the time, you got to learn to think about that. It doesn't make sense. Stop for a moment and think about it. You'll know that driving by the dope guy's house to see if he's still living at the same place, there's no sense in that. But most often we have the thought, we just do it until we can learn to think it through.
Do you remember that quote from Viktor Frankl, between stimulus and response, there's a space?
Right.
And that space is our power to choose our response, and our response lies our growth and our freedom. The problem with addicts and people who are survivors of trauma is there is no space. It is stimuli from the world that is immediately abutted to an instinctual behavior, not an intentional one, but instinctual. So we got to get some space in between those two places, some space between when I get stimulated from the world, when somebody yells at me or somebody cuts me off in traffic or somebody, you know, hurts my feelers, that I've got to surrender first. I got to dial down. I got to let go. And when I let go, now everything is possible. When I stay jacked up, then all I can do is what I've always done, is that I move into what you described was the thoughts become racing. The thoughts talk to me and command me to act aggressively. They command me to do something that I don't want to do. And I am powerless to stop myself once I'm in that state of jacked upness and I've got that voice commanding me up here saying, you know, kick his ass or get away from that, you know, whatever else. It's usually aggression or avoidance. And so, you know, knowing that I get freedom from surrender is, I think, the blessing of the first to the second step. That bridge of hope is knowing that when I let go, I gain a far greater power. When I let go of control, I gain a far greater power.
I thought about so many things as you were saying all that. So many things. In my first book, Taming the Dragon, I actually wrote that the ego is constantly screaming. That part that you were talking about, constantly screaming, stop, go faster, go left, go right. And we listen without any thought about it. Part of what we have to do is to hear that screaming and then stop. Okay, maybe turning left right now is not the thing to do. But if we don't at least think about it, then we're constantly reacting and we're not in control of anything. We're just doing. We become that human doing that I heard about back in my, instead of a human being. And it's difficult to have peace in that place. It's impossible to have peace in that place, I think.
What I've kind of come to understand that hope is, how do I keep hope alive in my life? Well, I think it's the 11-step process. It is making a decision hundreds of times a day to let go and let the God, as I understand God, which is just goodwill as best I can tell, let that force that has given me all the goodness in my life direct me rather than my ways and means committee of what I want, you know, that to just let go hundreds of times a day. When I do that, I know I'm going to come out okay on the other side of it.
Right. You brought up a good point, which is part of where I want this podcast to go today. I've had no telling how many people asking me over the years on step two, Johnny, what is this power that I'm coming to believe in? What is this power that's supposed to give me all this hope? So how do you respond to that? Or have you ever been asked that?
My sponsor just did a beautiful thing with me around that, because I was having all kinds of problems with God. He started with the idea that, you know, the second step has nothing to do with God. And here's what I want you to do, Eric, is I want you to just wake up in the morning for the next 90 days. And I want you to just ask whatever is out there. If it's the universe, if it's your higher self, whatever it is, doesn't matter what you call it. I'm just going to ask you to ask that thing to show itself to you. Demonstrate that there is a force in the universe that cares about me. And would you please reveal yourself to me? He said, what I want you to do is for the next 90 days is, he held his hands out. We're going to do a scale. We're going to start with, there are no powers greater than you that will help you. And there is power greater than you that will help you. I'm going to ask that you ask for it and just notice what happens. And, you know, the thing that happens is that when we get willing to see that stuff is there were hundreds of little coincidences in the first week of where I started noticing that there was some kind of something beyond me that cared about me and that was constantly calling me to do right and was available for comfort and a source of strength. And I just kept feeling and experiencing that in all kinds of little ways. And, wow, you know, I wasn't using and I was losing the desire to use. And, you know, my life was getting better. And I think that process of just having thousands of experiences of seeing it work in my life, and that's what I've heard from other people who are in recovery, is that when we do it, it works. And, you know, we start understanding that it's not a power. It's a myriad of powers. There's just thousands of things available to me to help me in my life today.
Wow, man. So many memories you bring up for me, man. I had such a resentment with this whole God concept when I first came to the program, because as a kid, I was told he took my mother from me. And then they told me I needed to turn to him for help. He took the most important thing in my life away from me. Now you're wanting me to ask him for help. Are you crazy? So what I did, I'll never forget my first prayer. I got on my knees in a room that my wife and I had at the time. And I said, look, I don't know what you are. I don't know where you are or how you do what they tell me you do. But they told me that if I would turn to you, that my life would change. Next thing you know, I worked 8 hours and I only turned in 8 hours. If I worked 6 hours, I only turned in 6 hours. And I remember one of the really big ones was one day I walked into a Kmart and I was looking at the sunglasses and I did what I had done so many times before. I just put them on, looked at myself in their little mirror, and then walked out with them. But this time, after saying that prayer, I got out into the parking lot and I realized I had those glasses on. And I'm like, oh my God. They told you that if you don't get honest, you will pick up. I turned around, damn near jogged back into Kmart, went back to the sunglass rack and just put them back. There's no way I would have ever done that on my own, by my own vices. No way in hell. And then all kinds of other little things. I managed to, you know, one of the big freedoms for me in my early recovery, I was always trying to fix stuff on my wife's car. I am not a mechanic. And I go, she say it's making this noise. I go up and try to work on it. I come back, she drive it off. She come back, she say it's still making the noise. Well, after I've been clean for a little while and learning a little bit about honesty, I came in one day and she said, Johnny, the car is making that noise. I said, we need a mechanic because I don't know how to fix that. She said, thank you. It was such a freedom to be able to tell the truth and say, I don't know. I didn't know how to do that prior. Yeah, the little miracles. And one of the things when I'm trying to work with somebody that I tell them all the time is you got to celebrate your little victories. And, you know, quit thinking you're going to be the CEO tomorrow and just be grateful that you got a job and just be grateful that you managed to actually do a 40-hour week. Celebrate the little victories and they will pile up. I love what you were saying. One of the things that I've always loved about the 12 steps is in 3 and 11 where it says, as we understood him. And I get to believe what works for me. And that is so important to me, you know, and I've said this a lot. The God of my understanding may get you high before tomorrow morning, but he's working just fine for me. Yeah, so it's beautiful. And the thing that I love about how the steps are laid out, another one of the many things I love, is we go from hope in step 2. And once that hope has been realized to some degree, it starts to gradually turn into trust. And then that trust carries us right into step 3. Those steps had to be divinely inspired because me and you never could have sat down and come up with this crap. There's no way. No two human minds could sit down and come up with that without a divinity being involved. No way.
From the choir comes an amen.
Good.
On my wall that I'm looking at right now is Rembrandt von Rogen's last painting, and it's The Return of the Prodigal Son. It is my third step. It's what I wrote my song Crawling about. I don't know if you've ever read that book by Henry Nouwen, but it's just a beautiful illustration of spiritual maturation, and he talks about there are three things that a person has to do to spiritually mature through the characters of those three in the parable of the prodigal son. And the first thing is we got to find ourselves sleeping with the swine. You know, we have to have found ourselves having squandered our inheritance, sleeping with the swine, and in a place that we don't want to be. And I love that what it takes to get up from the swine and come back home is the death of the ego, because I couldn't do it on my own. And it's the hope that I will be able to get some succor, some comfort, some restitution of myself if I come back home and knowing I don't deserve it. And what happens is we, as the prodigal sons and daughters, we come back home and we are given back our inheritance. We're given back this thing from a loving power greater than ourselves. And that little piece of hope, you know, and that process is threefold, because once I get back home, now I'm styling. Now I become the older brother. And I'm like, well, he shouldn't get all of this good stuff because he didn't stay. And I become entitled and egotistical. And I got to continue to surrender that stuff too. And I can move on into the 11th and 12th step and become the father, welcoming other folks home. And anytime anybody in a meeting picks up a white tag, I always say, every single time, I always say, welcome home. I'm knowing that that person has been on their prodigal son or daughter trip on their way to get back home. And that's a pretty sweet way of looking at that, I think.
Right. Yeah. Because I raise butterflies and I build butterfly gardens and I use the butterfly, the life of the butterfly, a lot of times to describe the process of addiction. The caterpillar, from the time it exits the egg until it enters the chrysalis, it is a taker. All it does is eat. It'll eat everything in its path that is its plant of choice until finally it surrenders. It hangs upside down and it goes through this tour. If you ever watch the process of the caterpillar becoming the chrysalis, it's horrible. It loses its head. It twists around. It covers up with this molten stuff and its head literally falls off. And then it hangs there for almost 2 weeks. And when it emerges, at first, it looks beaten and torn because the wings are all knotted up. It looked like a wash rag somebody tried to wring out. But then through that struggle of coming out, its wings straighten out. And it needs that struggle of coming out of the cocoon for the chrysalis for that to happen. And then as a butterfly, to me, it's the addict that's in full recovery, because that butterfly is no longer the taker that the caterpillar was. All it does is gives. It goes from one plant to the other, carrying pollen with it as it goes. It doesn't eat the plant. It doesn't destroy the plant. It is the giver, which is what we, in my mind, are meant to become as a result of the 12 steps. We become givers. We become, hopefully, bringers of light, bringers of hope. It's such a beautiful process. Seriously, when we were active addicts, I wasn't giving you anything unless there was something in it for me. And today, that is not my life. That is not my story. That is not my reality. It's a beautiful thing to be in recovery, having done and living the principles, having done the 12 steps and then living the principles that they convey. It's a beautiful life.
One more, amen.
So two
excellent metaphors about that process, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I have videos, the caterpillar becoming the chrysalis. And if you watch that, it's painful, man. It's got to be painful. And then I think of that time within the chrysalis as what you were referring to about the prodigal son, like the dark night of the soul, because in that chrysalis, we explore the darkness. And in that chrysalis, we are learning the value of the darkness. And then we get to come out. We get to be beautiful people. Man, beautiful people are people who live in this planet with all the insanity going on and not being the insanity that's going on. You can see it and be detached from it and be like, oh my God, man, that's horrible, but it's not mine. It's not mine. What we're going to do here is we're going to pause so that at the end here, our sound editor can throw in your song, because people need to hear that. It's beautiful. I do remember it. And I remember it touched me. So we're going to pause and then we'll pick back up.
I believe. It's 4 a.m. and I just can't sleep. Scared and alone and in way too deep. Grappling with demons, fighting with God. Nowhere to turn, so I pick up the phone. You're not my mother, you're not my father. You're not my God, but you're on the other end. You share your strength and your hope and your love with me. I find a little for myself and I've come to believe.
Thank you. I know everyone will enjoy that. Really worth hearing. Eric, by the way, with that being brought up, tell us a little bit about your music life.
Well, I'm busy in my professional life right now, too much so that I'm able to move very much forward in my music. But in 2013, I did a 14-song CD I tried to do just a slice of life. I wanted to do an album that captured what happens in a meeting. And so there's 14 songs about getting and living clean and in recovery, and it's called Clean, and that's the name of the ensemble. And if anybody's interested in it, you can listen and download the songs for free. It's at Clean, K-L-E-E-N, music, cleanmusic.com. And I invite you to go and check out any of it, if any of it speaks to you. It's my 12th step, and it's kind of the way that I practice that, is I just give that music away. I think I've sold like 6 copies of it. My producer said, Eric, you want to know how to make a small fortune in music? And I said, yeah, for sure. He said, start with the large one.
That's cool. Okay, I want to say to our audience, guys, I really want you to think about our guest here today, because of all that he does, all that he's doing. I mean, along with the work that he does, I love his music. I love the lyrics to his music. They have meaning. They have depth. This guy's the real deal. He's the real deal. And go to his site and find out more about what he's doing. And what is that site, Eric?
The best one would be aztrauma.org, Arizona Trauma Institute, aztrauma.org. I'm the vice president of that organization, and we're doing a lot of really cool stuff.
Great. I know you are. I know my life wouldn't be what it is without the help I got from you, and that's just real. So I want to thank everybody for listening. I want to tell you to tune in because Eric and I will be doing this again. I've got my fingers crossed on that one.
Happy to.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. Keep coming back and go to johnnycalloway.com. You can listen to all my other podcasts. Soon you'll be able to buy my book, Dragons and Butterflies, on there, and my two new books that are coming out in June, The Bridge Where Souls Connect and Taming the Dragon. Thank you very much. Okay, everybody, thanks for listening. Remember, never give up. Always keep it real and take time to smell the roses. And please sit down and watch a butterfly. Keep up with all that we are doing by going to morphintoanewyou.com. Thank you very much.